From Hologram Radio, this is Covered, a conversation about books with the people who write them. It's a new season with a new theme song and a new guest. I'm your host, Harry Marks, and today's guest is a poet, short story writer, playwright, and the author of the USA Today bestselling novel, The Magician's Lie. Her new book, Girl in Disguise, tells the story of the first female detective in the United States and has been hailed by Publishers Weekly as, quote, an exciting, well-crafted historical novel loaded with suspense and action. And here she is to tell us all about it. Please welcome Greer McAllister to the show.
Hey, great to be here.
Happy to have you. So Kate Warren was the first female detective, and I hadn't heard about her before. How did you come to tell her story?
Well, I get asked this question a lot, and I really wish I had a better answer for it, because I don't actually remember the first time that I ran across her name. I know that it was not that many years ago, and that was sort of what the impetus was to write the book. I was, you know, mumbly-mumble years old in my late 30s and ran across her name on the vast wide internet and couldn't understand why I had never seen anything about her. She was the first female detective. She was hired 161 years ago in 1856. She helped save Abraham Lincoln's life. She did all these amazing things. And yet there had been no mention of her anywhere that I had seen. And so obviously I've run across a number of mentions of her since then, but that was the very first trigger to say, oh, there's this great untold story. Maybe I should take a stab at telling it.
Would you mind reading a little bit from the book just to give people a taste?
Sure, I'd be happy to do that. I have a short section. It's from the very beginning of the book, so okay. It gives you a sense of Kate's world. Chapter one is called The First Disguise, and we start off in August 1856. Like any Chicago tavern in deep summer, Joe Mulligan's stank. It stank of cigars smoked the week before, months before, years before. Tonight, smoke pooled against the basement ceiling in a noxious cloud. I acted like I smelled only roses. The woman I was pretending to be would have done the same. I was also pretending the sharp tang of men's sweat surrounding me didn't terrify me. These were not good men. But I wasn't a good woman, not tonight. My mission was to ignore the smoke and the sweat, blind a bad man with a wicked smile, and wring out his secrets. There would be no second chance. So I breathed as shallowly as I could and made my way through the crowd to the bar. Men's bodies brushed mine, hips and hands and God only knows what, lingering on my shoulder and everywhere below. My nerves frayed and I stumbled. With anything less at stake, I would have fled Joe Mulligan's as if it were on fire. But I needed the money. The money would save me. Drink, snapped the barkeep. I squared my shoulders and answered him as the woman I was pretending to be.
You know, not much is known about Kate Warren, and in my research for the show, I struggled to come up with much of anything. It seems like a lot of her case files had been lost to fire and time. What kind of research did you do in preparing her story for the book?
Well, there was a fortuitous angle to it that I had just moved to Washington, D.C. right when I started writing the book, and the Pinkerton Agency archives are in the Library of Congress. So I figured that, you know, the internet had not turned up much at all about Kate. I figured the Pinkerton records would be the best place to look because she didn't, because that's the agency that she worked for. But I went and I got my library card and I spent a day there. And by the end of the day, I had read everything that there was to read in those records about Kate Warren. So even in theirs, as you mentioned, fire, the Great Chicago Fire of 1871 took out a lot of their stuff. And then apparently there was a fire later in the 30s that I read about. So the stuff that was even written down in the first place was not always kept. And we have Pinkerton's word to go on, but he did not always stick strictly to the truth when he put his books together because truth was not his aim. He was a PR guy. So we believe that we know when she was hired. We believe that she was a widow. There's a lot of information that may or may not be true. But in the Pinkerton Agency records themselves, there are really only about four or five cases that we know for sure that she worked on. And so if I had been a biographer, that would have been very upsetting. But luckily, I am a historical novelist, so I got to take the historical fiction angle and do some history and a lot of fiction.
What is it like to balance the fiction with the historical? And what is the balance for historical fiction between the truth and what you're putting into the novel to tell a good story? I mean, is how delicate is that balance?
It's definitely delicate, and I think the answer is different for everybody who tackles historical fiction, and then also depending on what you're working with. You know, my struggle was, I don't have that much to work with. I'm going to be making up a lot of narrative. I'm going to be giving Kate a voice because she didn't leave any diaries or letters. So there's going to be a lot of synthesis and a lot of creation. And some people who are working with well-documented history have the opposite problem, where there's so much, they have to pick and choose what they are going to use. I think most of us feel free to change history if we have a good reason to. It's sort of like the issue of it's okay to break the rules as long as you know them. So if I accidentally said that, you know, she spent some time in Richmond, that would be a problem. But if I say in my author's note, you know, she was never known to go to Richmond, but for the purposes of the story flow, I put her there, then that's sort of okay. And that's how you get, you know, so many different books about Zelda Fitzgerald, so many different books about people who are better known. Everyone has their own version of that particular person. And we all know it isn't exactly the person that it was. But that's also true of biography. Even if you are trying to stick to the facts, if you weren't there in the room, you don't know for sure exactly if you're recording history. So with historical fiction, I think you want to pay respects to the person whose life you're drawing on. You want to share whatever degree of truth you can of the story of the real person, but you also want to give the reader a really fun experience. You want them to enjoy it. And there are some cases where I know I've read books where, you know, 3 years passes in real history. And I read in the author's note, they say, well, this 3 years passed, but if I had just written a book where you were sitting with the person for 3 years in this particular place, it would have been horribly boring and it wouldn't have related to anything else in the book. So I cut it out. You know, everybody's sort of wanting to serve the reader and wanting to serve history and wanting to serve, you know, our own preferences as writers. You know, I wanted Kate to have a certain personality. And so that was the personality I gave her, but it's based in what she actually did. You know, she walked into Pinkerton's office and asked for a job at a time that most women didn't work outside the home. It wouldn't even have occurred to most women to answer this newspaper ad for operatives. And that's something she did. So that was something that I gave her the personality to do.
Today's episode is brought to you by Nacht Sound Engineering. Nacht helps you record, edit, and produce great podcasts, streamlining the process so you can deliver high-quality shows to your audience. Whether you just need to trim the ums and you knows, or you're looking to set up the perfect recording rig, Nacht has it all covered. Speaking of, Nacht makes every episode of this podcast sound terrific. Consider this more than just an advertisement, consider it an endorsement. So if you're looking to bring your podcast to the next level, contact Nacht Sound Engineering today at nachtsound.com. That's nachtsound.com. Nacht, more than a stack of tracks. Yeah, and I notice you do it in your book, and I see it a lot of times in historical books and movies where they will combine a character and create a whole new character for the narrative. And did you do that with this book because you wanted to give her a love interest and that love interest hadn't actually existed, or was there something else?
Yeah, I mean, it's entirely possible that she did have a love interest that we don't know about. But we have, you know, in reading about her, like I said, there were only a few cases that we knew that she worked on. So I did some deep reading into other Pinkerton agents of the time, what was available on them. And one of the best known is Timothy Webster, who, well, I don't know if it's too much spoilers, but I didn't use his whole story, but I did run across him many times because what happened to him was well documented. So I kind of wanted to use him, but at the same time, I wanted him to do things that I do not believe the historical Timothy Webster did. So that's where Tim Bellamy comes from, is he's inspired by a real Pinkerton agent of the time. But when I changed things enough that it no longer matched the historical character, I gave him a different name.
What draws you to historical fiction? Because this isn't your first foray. Magician's Lie, even though it was entirely fictional, is still a historical fiction.
Right, right. And I kind of accidentally ended up writing historical fiction because with The Magician's Lie, the inspiration was just the fact that I had never seen, you know, if you think about magicians, stage magicians, illusionists, they do a few things are very commonly known for. They have doves up their sleeves. They cut people in half. They pull rabbits out of hats. But if you ask someone to picture a magician cutting someone in half, they will pretty much always come up with a male magician cutting a woman in half. And I wondered why I'd never seen anything about a female magician cutting a man in half. And when I did the research into it, it was actually not until the 1980s that a female illusionist had that as her signature act. So I could have written a book based on that. I could have written a book of a modern day magician, you know, somebody in Vegas or YouTube or something and had that story. But I really wanted to set that book at the golden age of magic, where most people would have seen an illusionist at one point. They would have gone to a vaudeville show and there would have been magic on the bill. And it would have made front page news if a female magician had been cutting men in half. And so that means historical fiction. That meant I had to research when it would have been plausible for a woman to do that. And that turned out to be in the 1890s. So I love historical fiction. I love reading it because it transports you somewhere that you can't go. You know, you can be transported by fiction. Science fiction, you know, transports you somewhere you can never go. Contemporary fiction emotionally transports you somewhere, but it can also physically transport you to a place that does exist. And historical fiction will take you back to somewhere that you could never go, but make you feel like you're there.
You seem to have a pattern of flipping gender stereotypes on their head, of women pursuing male professions. And this sort of goes into an article you had written for The Millions about female empowerment in historical fiction. And I did want to ask you about how that came about.
Yeah, that's something I wanted to do. I've been sort of expanding my writing into essays because there are a lot of the great thought is taking place there. I feel now on the internet, people write essays and discuss them, and social media sort of uses that as the fuel for our fire to talk about what the major issues are today in writing and in society. So I wrote for The Millions because this particular quote from Hilary Mantel, who writes historical fiction, she said that women who write about the past can't resist empowering women of the past in a way that they were not actually empowered. And that really the choice is between, are you going to rewrite history or are you going to reinforce women's status as victims by showing what life was actually like? And I don't believe that's a real choice. I've read so many fantastic historical novels written by men or women, set in the past about women, that recognize that women's lives, you know, society was constraining women. Society still constrains women, but women were constrained, but it wasn't that they were victims and it wasn't that they never had their own ideas and thoughts and spirit. So I find it fascinating to either recognize real women of the past or write these what if stories. What if there had been a woman who did this or that, and center stories on the female experience. And that, you know, that's what I enjoy reading. That's what I enjoy writing. I don't think I need to hand down a dictate that that's the only thing that women are allowed to write about, because obviously everybody's got their inspiration. And that's what happens to be most inspiring for me right now.
There's also to her point about, you know, you can't, it's hard to empower women who weren't empowered in the first place, but there is that what if aspect about it. There are these hot takes and thought pieces about this god-awful Confederate thing going on with the Game of Thrones people, and, you know, this what if the South actually won. But then there's also, you know, what if Joan of Arc cut herself free and escaped being burned alive and all that. There is that sort of, I like to think of it as like the death wish philosophy, like or wondering, you know, what if I was Paul Kersey seeking vengeance for something wrong to my family kind of thing. You know, what if those women actually weren't the victims or weren't set on the sidelines? And I feel like there's a need for that. You know, women need to, there's a representation issue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think if we had only, you know, there have been thousands of books about, you know, George Washington did this thing and isn't that inspiring, but telling the stories, you know, the women don't have to be the generals in order for them to be important in wartime. So you can either, you know, put them in a different place than they were, or you can recognize the place where they actually were, because that doesn't get told enough.
Right. Well, there's that fantastic story you mentioned when we first started, and it's in the book, about Kate Warren smuggling Lincoln to his inauguration. And I read it and I was like, oh, wow, that was a great story. And I looked it up. I was like, oh, my God, that actually happened.
That happened. Yeah, it was crazy. So, yeah. So in 1861, Lincoln was on his way to his inauguration, and the Pinkertons figured out that there was a plot against him, that he was going to be intercepted in Baltimore. And it was the Pinkertons, including Kate Warren, who kept that from happening. I used most of what she actually did. There were a couple of cases that didn't quite fit in because I did need to serve the narrative, but that sort of became the thrust of the plot. You know, I sort of hung the action on that, because I'm like, I can't not put that in there. That's got to go in there.
Well, how much of that was still around as documentation? Because that seems like a pretty big story to get lost.
Yeah, it's interesting. And there was a book, there was a nonfiction book about it, I think in 2014, called The Hour of Peril by Daniel Stashower. So I read that. And so that plot is documented. It just hasn't sort of become legend in the way that, you know, his successful assassination was. You hear, you know, endless stories about John Wilkes Booth, but you don't, you know, the good news and the bad news is that the assassination plot was stopped. So he wasn't actually killed then. And I think that event then got overshadowed by when he wasn't saved. But the saving, I mean, how different would history have been if that first assassination attempt had been successful? So there is enough documentation around that plot to pick out some of the names, to pick out some of what happened. But I did sort of mess around with it a little bit for the sake of narrative. So if you want to know the true documentation, what exists about what actually happened minute by minute in that assassination attempt, The Hour of Peril was the book to go to.
How involved was Kate in that subterfuge? Was she as involved as you make her out to be, or was there a little bit of finagling there?
It's not entirely clear what she did as much leading up to it, but she did accompany Lincoln. She did pretend to be his sister as he was pretending to be an invalid on the train on the way there.
That's so cool. I do want to talk to you about the title and the use of the word girl. And a friend of mine and a former guest of the show, Steph Post, had written an article about all the girl titles and how it's kind of a tired motif in titles, girl, Gone Girl, Girl on a Train. But in a Publisher's Weekly interview, you say, quote, but her male colleagues, about Kate Warren, but her male colleagues see her as a girl, for one thing, and she asks herself at one point whether she's a good girl disguising herself as a bad one or the other way around, end quote. Do you worry that the title Girl in Disguise undermines the work she did by framing her in such a way?
Oh, I worry about everything. Yeah. the amount of second guessing that goes on in publishing is truly amazing. And so, yeah, I mean, the title, it could have just as easily been Woman in Disguise. There was a really, really crazy coincidence where there's literally a book that came out the same day called The Lady in Disguise. So it's, I'm glad I didn't go with that one, because it would have been really, really confusing. But yeah, I mean, there were people, and titles are always a collaboration. I feel like covers are always a collaboration with publishers and agents and designers and lots of people getting involved. So there were definitely people who advocated for, you know, don't put girl in the title. And there were people who advocated for absolutely put girl in the title, because girl has now taken on sort of this thriller connotation,
right,
this danger connotation.
Final Girls by Riley Sager. And
yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And The Girls by Emma Klein.
Right.
And
great book.
It's just sort of this near constant. And people are writing about it, like you said, as they should. I think we should sort of interrogate these things and discuss them. But I do think that it's a trend, and I think it is sort of on the way out. But publishing just sort of flows in this inexorable tide. And so there will be another word that we're, sick of soon enough. And that one, I think, is the one we're sick of right now.
Since we're talking about the process and the publishing industry, tell me about the process to get the book written. And you said you had spent a day looking at the case files for her, but what other research did you compile?
I did a few different approaches. So finding out what actually happened in Kate's life that made it into the historical record was the library and the internet. And then I did a lot of reading on what Chicago was like at the time, because I knew some of it was going to be set in Chicago. And that was such an interesting time in Chicago. And they were doing some of the things I describe in the book of, lifting the streets up to put sewers underneath it. In Chicago, they even changed the direction of the river, although that didn't happen during the time period that I'm writing about. But Chicago history is fascinating. I wanted to get that in there. I read the books, not all of the books, but the books that were relevant to the time that Alan Pinkerton wrote, because he was very active as a self-promoter. He made sure there were newspaper articles. He wrote his own books or had books written and released about all the amazing things that the Pinkerton Agency did. So there was quite a bit of material to draw from on there, including what types of cases they were working at the time. So I was able to pinpoint some of that. And I had not intended to write a book set in the Civil War period, but because that's when Kate actually was working, I did a bunch of watching movies and reading other books set in the Civil War period, just to sort of try to get a feeling for it. And in this particular area, I feel like my daughter was really helpful because I had just given birth about a month before I was trying to write this thing. And I could only research. I couldn't write. And so I had a problem in the first book balancing how do you write and how do you research at the same time. And so with Girl in Disguise, I had to do a bunch of the research first because I couldn't form coherent thoughts really for a couple of months. So I'm up at 4 a.m. and trying to watch Ken Burns' Civil War series, which meant that I fell asleep on the couch at 4 a.m. But it was, I was able to sort of divide, here is a research period and then here is a writing period, as opposed to, okay, I have an hour today. Am I going to research or am I going to write, or how am I going to split up the process between those two things?
Do you ever wake up in a cold sweat hearing a Ashokan farewell or anything like that? You talk about while you were pregnant, you were balancing writing and researching at the same time. And with this one, you had to research everything first and then write the book. Do you have a preference for which method works best?
I feel like I have to do a certain amount of research before I can start writing, because otherwise I end up having to get rid of a bunch of stuff. I need to figure out certain logistical things. Like in The Magician's Lie, there's a period where they walk from through a certain stretch of the East Coast. And I needed to know, okay, are they going to walk? Are they going to take the train? Are they going to take a steamship? What was possible at the time? And what would people who didn't have money have been most likely to do? So I didn't want to write a whole stretch about them on a train and then find out that they never would have been able to afford a train. So logistical things like that I will sometimes do. But I learned with The Magician's Lie, if somebody needs to put on a hat, don't stop writing in order to go figure out what the hat looks like. Make a little note about the hat and keep writing. Like, don't stop writing. And you can do the research at another time. But I do go back and forth now. I try to get a month or two of research in first and then start writing. And then as I write, I discover what else I need to research.
Is there ever a worry about too much research?
Like I said, I worry about absolutely everything. So that is certainly part of the process.
I'm going to ask, do you worry? And then just assume, yes, yes, you do.
Yes, exactly. but too much research, I think that is a danger. I don't think I've gotten there yet. But at some point, I can't spend a year researching and then start writing. I have to start writing in order to discover what research I need. People, different people divide things up differently, but I have to be writing it so that I can discover the character and figure out sort of what's happening. I do write outlines. I do write overall, synopses, but I always end up changing them in the process. So the writing process has to not just come at the end.
I have to remember that because I'm working on a new book and I want to set it sort of a dual time frame, with one half set around Thomas Jefferson's later years in Monticello and the other time frame now. And I feel like I have to do a year worth of research, read all these biographies about Jefferson and the house and everything before I can even think about starting work on this, especially if I want to write in his voice. And I just, I have this horrible, like, I feel like there's this mountain I have to climb before I can even start, you know, before I can reach the typewriter at the very top of the mountain kind of thing.
It's an interesting way to think about it. I think it just depends on how comfortable you are with rewriting, because I'm a very sloppy writer. I write a ton of stuff and then throw it out or move it somewhere or change it up. But I know a lot of people who they want that first draft to be most of the way there. And so you would have to get a really good sense of his voice if you want to have that voice right on the first pass through.
Right. I know there are some people who are, you know, they'll write dialogue and they'll say, they'll literally write something like character says something witty and then they'll decide to fix it later. And I can't write that way. I need to get it as close as I can in the moment.
Yeah, I have notes to myself in my current manuscript that say, make this make sense. and then I get mad at my former self. I'm like, what did you mean by that? Couldn't you have been more specific?
Yeah, that's something future Greer can worry about.
Exactly. Yeah, future Greer is reaping what past Greer has sown.
You're a podcaster and blogger. You need an analytics and hosting platform that provides you with the right tools to make your job easier, so you can get back to doing what you do best, creating stuff. FeedPress is a delightfully intuitive RSS analytics and podcast hosting platform with accurate analytics for RSS feeds and email newsletters. Bloggers and podcasters tap into RSS subscriber, geolocation, podcast download, and link tracking metrics, which come standard on all plans. In a matter of minutes, podcasters can create a feed and publish to iTunes, add your show notes, artwork, and drag and drop an MP3 into the editor to go live. Every podcast plan comes with 400 megabytes of file storage that's unmetered. This means you won't have to worry about running out of storage for long episodes or getting dinged for a sudden spike in download traffic when your podcast becomes an overnight success. FeedPress offers an automatic feed burner migration tool so you can make that transition with ease. Your feeds and subscriber data will be moved into your FeedPress account. And if you're currently hosting a podcast elsewhere, they can help you migrate your feeds and media files over so that your listeners don't notice you've changed anything. Support is responsive and available 7 days a week via feed.press/contact. Sign up today and try FeedPress on a 14-day commitment-free trial at feed.press/covered. Use promo code COVERED during checkout to get 10% off your first year. So I'd like to talk about the publication of your first book, what that journey was like, because I always find the first is probably the hardest to get from draft to finished manuscript, or finished book, right, I should say.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Both. Yeah, I had met my agent. Well, I actually didn't even meet my agent to a conference. I went to a conference that my agent, my future agent, was also at. And I sent her a query and said, hey, I, you know, saw your panel at this thing and you were talking about one of your authors who's writing stuff similar to what I'm writing. Would you take a look at this book? And she took a look at that book and she liked it, but she didn't love it. So she actually did not take that one on to represent. But the next one I wrote, she did take on. So I had gone through the same process that I think a lot of people go through of years and years of sending queries and writing books and hoping for publication and not quite getting there. But when I did finally get there, it was with The Magician's Lie. And that book took me probably about 5 years between initial idea and then actually turning in the last draft to my editor. Hmm. And then, of course, after that turned in, then there's still another, you know, up to a year of finalization and waiting for it to be printed and getting it on calendars and all that stuff. So that was sort of a 5 year process for me. And I think, you know, I'm very, very happy with the result. And I don't know if I could have done it more efficiently, but because of the dual time frame, I think it was particularly challenging to revise. But so much of my work happens in revision. and Girl in Disguise, which was much faster and more straightforward. And I think those two things are probably related.
How involved was your agent in the, I guess, the initial production of Girl in Disguise? Because I've heard, I talked to a friend of mine who's like, yeah, my agent and I are sort of going back and forth on some ideas I have. Did you tell her the idea and she said, yeah, go for it? Or was there some pushback there?
The idea really went through my editor. So I talked to my agent and said, hey, I need to decide what I'm going to write next. Mm-hmm. Here are some things that I'm thinking about. She said, okay, those both sound good. Why don't you talk to your editor about it and see which one she's more interested in? And so I scheduled a meeting with my editor, with the one who had published The Magician's Lie, and said, I have this one idea for a book about the magician Adelaide Herman, and here's what I would call it, and here are some sample chapters, and here's an outline and everything else. Or I could write a book about the first female Pinkerton agent. And she said, oh, first female Pinkerton agent? That sounds interesting. Write that. So I did. And I think it's actually, it was the better choice between those two. Because it is. She said the same thing I said. Why haven't I heard her name before? Why don't I know who Kate Warren is? What do we really know about her and who was she? So I think that's the same. If I had that sort of, I hesitate to call it a hook, but it is something that you get caught on. So
right.
It draws you in. It pulls you in. I had that thought. She had that thought. Readers have that thought. And if you have a book with something like that, it gives you sort of a natural advantage, a good starting place, as opposed to, there are just so many books. There's so many books. And I feel like when I was an aspiring author, I wished that publishers would publish more books. And as a published author, I kind of wish they would publish fewer because there's so much competition for readers' eyeballs these days.
Yeah, it's funny. I came across your book just wandering around Barnes & Noble, and it was the Fifth Avenue store in New York, and it was faced out, mm-hmm. and it had the big autograph sticker in the bottom corner, so you had signed it. So I have an autograph mm-hmm. book, thank you.
Excellent.
And I picked up, the cover struck me first, and I picked it up, and I'm reading through the jacket copy, and I was like, this is awesome. This sounds really fascinating. So I bought it based on that and the blurbs on the back. There, every once in a while, someone on Twitter will ask, does anyone actually care about the blurbs on the jacket? And I say, yes, absolutely. That a lot of times that is what will sell me. Mm-hmm. I had Emily Fridlin's History of Wolves pitched as, if you liked Emma Klein's The Girls, you'll like this. And I was like, sold. I'm good. Mm-hmm. I will take mm-hmm. it. So you're right. There is competition for readers, especially in the age of Amazon, where you're just scrolling endlessly through, little thumbnails and stuff. But being able to peruse a bookstore and just come across a book like yours is incredibly helpful.
Yeah. Yeah. You mentioned the title, there's only so much information that a reader has. And so you work very hard to get the title right. You work very hard to get the cover right. You work on that back right. cover copy and try to get the blurbs from fellow authors because you want that, you want that moment where somebody says, oh, I'm going to reach for this one instead of that one.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel there's an obligation, especially now with everything going on with our current presidential situation, for lack of a more vulgar term,
that was very diplomatically put.
Yeah, that there's kind of an obligation to shine the light on people like Kate Warren who would otherwise still be forgotten to history.
I find it inspiring. So those are the books that I enjoy reading, and those are the books that I enjoy writing. I think if a writer isn't inspired by that, then they shouldn't force it. Mm-hmm. But I do think that having these stories out there, look at Hidden Figures, mm-hmm. the power of that real story that hadn't made it into the history books, but now people know that these Black women were so instrumental to our success, as a civilization almost. The idea of going to space is just so powerful.
Right.
And I never would have guessed that these women were involved with it. So that's a huge service for people to get that story out. And I think that the more that you know about what women did in the past, the more You inspire the girls of the future. And the more that women of today can say, hey, you know, I could do something extraordinary because these women did things that were extraordinary.
Right. Are there any other badass women of history on your radar for the next one?
Oh, gosh, so many. Well, the next one is partially inspired by the badass woman, Nellie Bly, who was a journalist. But I didn't want to write about a journalist character. So mm-hmm. I have my main character does something that Nellie Bly did, but she doesn't do it as a journalist. She does it for her own personal reasons. Oh, okay. So I'm keeping that one a little bit hush hush. But that's it's 1888 San Francisco. And so it's another story of a woman in extraordinary circumstances doing something very, very interesting.
Do you think there will ever be a time when you write something contemporary and that you dive out of historical fiction for a little bit?
It's possible. I mean, I used to write contemporary before I took a turn with The Magician's Lie, but it's really every idea I've had in the past 5 years has been a historical fiction idea. Some turning slightly toward the supernatural. I mean, there's an element in The Magician's Lie that's a magical element, not on stage magic, but actual can't happen magic. Mm-hmm. And so the vein that I'm in now is more realism and more practical, but some of the ideas I have are sort of, here's a past with an extra element to it, versus here's the past that was, and here's what it looked like.
I'd like to know, because this season of the show is going to be entirely women authors, and I'd like to know what books by women authors have you read or been reading that you would like to recommend?
There are definitely a few. One that I'm reading right this minute is Kate Quinn's The Alice Network. Which, you know, very much inspired by the badass women of history. It's a fictional story, but it draws on some real characters and a real World War I spy network that was led by a woman. And so that's a really interesting story. And it's, you know, it's compelling. She's doing that dual time frame thing. And so she's drawing you in that way. There's a book that I think definitely did not get enough attention by H.P. Wood, but her real name is Hillary. Called Magruder's Curiosity Cabinet. And so it's just this rich tapestry of all these characters who sort of form a family that are sideshow performers in early 1900s Coney Island. Hmm. And it's just fantastic. You know, it turns out that I really apparently love, you know, turn of the century New York, because I love Church of Marvels by Leslie Perry. I love The Gollum and the Genie by Helene Wecker. And I was looking at a list of books that I love that I was trying to get together for another purpose. And I'm like, wow, there's a lot of that particular time and place. So those. And then I'm also reading The Marsh King's Daughter by Karen Dion, which is contemporary. And it's an interesting thriller with a type of protagonist that I hadn't seen before. She's the grown daughter of her mother, who had been kidnapped and held. And she's the main character here is the offspring of the woman and her captor. And her father has escaped from prison, and she's tracking him. And it all takes place in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. And it's just a unique story, really, really interesting. And so I'm definitely drawn to reading women authors right now. And so it's mostly historical, but occasionally there's something like Karen's book that sort of draws me in. I'm like, oh, okay, well, that's so unique. That's a story that I really want to jump into.
That last one sounds amazing. I have to look that one up.
Yeah. The Marsh King's Daughter.
Marsh King's Daughter. Excellent. Is there something with the industry and the way women are maybe pigeonholed to a degree? It's the best word I can come up with, but something that you'd like to see the industry change with the way women authors, the way their covers are designed, the way their books are sort of shoehorned into one category or the other, anything like that?
Well, it's really interesting. We could do a few hours just on that, right? but I do think it's interesting. You know, you'll go to a bookstore and you'll see a shelf that says women's fiction, and there is no shelf that says men's fiction.
Right. Men's fiction is fiction.
Right, right. Exactly. That's, you've got your Eugenides and your Francis and all that stuff. Even if you're writing about the same subjects, if you're mm-hmm. writing about marriage, if you're writing about domesticity, if you're writing about, affairs, that is an area where I think the gender of the author makes a big difference. And I always think it should be the book. And I think everybody, to some degree believes it doesn't matter who writes it. It matters, what it is. And what I found super interesting, and you probably read this article too, is now there was a trend where women writing thrillers would use their initials so that people would think they were men. So mm-hmm. you had J.D. Robb and you had, those people. Now there are men who are taking either women's names or initials to make people think that they are women, because female centered thrillers are a trend and they're really hot right now. And so everybody's trying to sort of get into that lane. But it is interesting how that exists at the exact same moment that, you know, the New York Times doesn't cover romance. And so there is sort of a gendering of genre and a gendering of authorship that I don't really think serves the reader in any way. I mean, we're all here for the readers. So that is something that I would like to see change.
Yeah, the Final Girls I had mentioned, I was looking it up because actually I wanted to ask Riley Sager to be on the show, and I did mm-hmm. some research, and Riley Sager's real name is like Matthew Wood or something.
That's right.
And I was like, oh, there goes that one. But it's funny that he not only gets the ambiguous, vaguely female name, but also girl in the title.
Right, exactly. Exactly. And what should matter is, you know, hopefully it's a good book. I haven't read it. It sounds like it's a good book.
I've heard it's fantastic. And I did read the opening chapters, and it really is very good. It's a shame that the work itself just can't stand on its own, that it needs to be branded in a certain way
right.
for it to be sold. And I never understood that, why, you know, not only, like, I would be frowned upon for reading Ellen Hildebrand, but her books are always derided as, you know, just fun kind of beach reads. But, you know, if Franzen turned around and decided to write about a group of women coming to terms with something on the Nantucket shores, like, that would be mm-hmm. high literature. That bothers me to a large degree.
And Nicholas Sparks claims that he does not write romance, and most romances that I have read have deeper, explorations of character and plot and better language and a whole lot of other things.
Oh, yeah.
But because he's Nicholas Sparks, that's a brand. Like you said, it's a brand thing.
Yeah, there's something wrong when you can't identify or consider yourself part of the genre you write for.
Mm-hmm.
That it's somehow beneath you. Like, then why even write it?
Well, and why is any genre beneath anyone? You know, genre is a handy way to say, you know, for me to say, oh, I like reading historical fiction. But there are plenty of people, as I've talked about this with my friends, and I went to the Historical Novel Society conference, I'm sort of in that community. And if you ask someone, related a story to me where she had asked a man about historical fiction as a ghetto, you know, as a derided genre. And he said, well, I don't write historical fiction. I'm like, you're at a historical novel conference. You clearly write historical fiction. But he viewed it as a negative term. And if you view it as a negative term, it will be a negative term. But if you don't, I mean, historical fiction has no more, of a quality barometer to it than contemporary fiction does. You can write terrible contemporary or wonderful contemporary. You can write terrible historical. You can write wonderful historical. So it's not, no genre is a good barometer of quality. It is just a word that helps you find a recommendation for what you want to read next.
Yeah, I write, the last book I had written was more of a thriller with some literary elements, but I've written a couple of literary novels, and when people ask, oh, what do you write? It actually feels gross to say the word literary fiction, because to me it sounds like hoity-toity, kind of, mm-hmm. you know, arrogant and stuff. And then at the same time, the people who are writing other genres look down on me or think of that, you know, oh, he writes literary fiction, he must, you know, think he's so important or whatever. And it's like, no, I'm just writing another genre like anybody else. It's, you know, we're all in this. I don't know why we need to be at each other's throats.
Agreed.
Thank you very much for coming on today. This is wonderful. I love the book. It was absolutely wonderful.
Thank you. I'm really glad I stopped in at Fifth Avenue and signed copies there.
I am too. Otherwise, I might not have seen it.
Right.
I say this all the time. This is just a huge testament to bookstores and libraries, because I've had some people call me out on social media for not talking about libraries enough. But librarians do the Lord's work, as do booksellers. So,
amen.
Yeah, it's they are necessities in our society for people to have places to get books. So, yes, definitely check out your local library or local bookstore, whichever you have near you, and seek out these books. So, Greer, where can people find you?
I am all over the interwebs. So the best source for information is my website, greermcallister.com. And because my last name is not always easy to spell, I did not use it on some of my other social media. So you can find me on Twitter at The Lady Greer, which is the same handle I use on Instagram, and also Litzy, if you're a Litzy person. It's sort of a cross between Goodreads and Instagram. And I'm trying to think if I'm anywhere else. And Facebook, Greer McAllister as well. And you can always, if people have questions directly for me, you can reach me through my website.
This has been Covered with special guest Greer McAllister. Links to Girl in Disguise and all other books discussed will be available in our show notes and on our website at hologramradio.org/covered. And thank you to our Patreon patrons, Sarah Blair, Tim Wassum, Alex Knight, and Aaron Mankey. If you're able to give a dollar or two an episode to help fund more great interviews like this one, please consider supporting Covered at patreon.com/covered. In addition to helping me make the show, you'll also gain access to ad-free versions of these episodes, as well as a bonus mini-episode at the $5 level. And if you fancy other Hologram Radio shows and would like to drop a few dollars their way, you can support the network as a whole at patreon.com/hologramradio, and at our new premium subscriber level at hologramradio.org/premium. This will give you access to all of our shows ad-free, as well as bonus content only available to premium subscribers for just $5 a month. Sign up now to get 1 week of free access. You can follow me on Twitter at HCMarks and the show at Covered_FM. Thank you to TJ Cosgrove for our beautiful logo, and Lorenzo Gudemi for all the hard work he puts into making this show sound fantastic. And as always, thank you again to Feed Press and Knocked Sound Engineering for their support of this show. And remember, don't judge a book till it's covered.